There are more than 120 different types of brain tumors, whether so-called benign or malignant, all can cause death or disability. Brain tumors are the leading cause of solid tumor cancer death in children and teens. Meningioma brain tumors, the most common type, affect twice as many women as men. Although termed benign, they are more deadly than breast cancer compared over a five-year period. My name is Maeve Riley, and this is the Afternoon Magazine. Today, our topic is surviving brain tumors. Our guests are Dr. Raul Rodas, neurologist, neurosurgeon, neurooncologist, and radiosurgeon at the Central Illinois Neuroscience Foundation, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the advancement of neurological health care through education and research. Dr. Rodas attended medical school at Michigan State University and did his residency at the University of Miami, as well as a fellowship at Roswell Park Cancer Institute in Buffalo and at the University of Michigan. He is on the advisory committee of the National Brain Tumor Foundation. Toby Hurges is a Champaign-Urbana native and a three-year survivor of an oligodendroglioma. Samantha Jane Scolamero is a 13-year survivor of an epidermoid cyst. She's the president and founding director of the Healing Exchange Brain Trust, an organization devoted to helping people communicate about brain tumors and related conditions via the internet to promote a healing exchange of support and information. You can join our conversation by calling 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, or toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. I'd like to thank you all for joining us today, and I'd like to relate in the interest of full disclosure that I'm interested in brain tumors because in May, my father was diagnosed with a glioblastoma multiforme, and since that time, I've been amazed by the amount of people I've met who've told me that they themselves have experienced a brain tumor, who have known someone who has had a brain tumor. So, Dr. Rodas, I wanted to ask you, do you think that there's a higher incidence of brain tumors now, or are we just getting better at diagnosing them?
I think, Maeve, you're right on both occasions, and it is kind of scary at certainly when you hear about so many people that you come in contact with directly, indirectly, who know someone or this and that, yeah, is affected by this sort of thing. And I think in part it's because of our heightened technology that we have now of imaging the brain and related structures that we're able to pick up some of these growths much earlier, many of which are symptomatic, but some of which have patients had no idea that they had. Yeah.
And are there any common tumor types specific to people that we might find in central Illinois or more common types that you might see in your practice?
Yes, and with that, just by statistics alone, as you've mentioned, in children, unfortunately, brain tumors are the second leading cause of death. And in adults, brain tumors actually only make up less than 10% of all the cancers that are known to us. But unfortunately, the significance and certainly the knowledge that goes into these sorts of tumors are very, very scattered, and many people aren't even aware of such things existing, actually. But I think that, again, from a statistical standpoint, metastatic tumors to the brain, metastasis meaning that the tumor had arisen from somewhere else in the body, like the lung, breast, prostate, which pretty infrequently goes to the brain. But these are in terms of numbers statistically, again, because they're very high in the general cancer community. And pelvic tumors, such as ovarian cancer and endometrial cancers, again, because they're relatively high, but they go very infrequently to the brain, they make up the bulk of the majority of types of tumors. So apart from metastatic tumors, then you look at the next common, and that's the primary brain tumor. Certainly, and it's not, those happen to be, most of them happen to be not benign types of growths that we will get into shortly. But the primary brain tumors arise from the normal structures of the brain, and they grow out of control. They produce predominantly their symptoms by pressure effects surrounding the brain tissues, and their symptoms can be quite varied, as we will soon find out.
All right, that's good. That leads me to Toby, who can talk a little bit about his diagnosis and symptoms that led up to discovering that he had a tumor.
Right. My tumor was primary, and I actually had no idea that there was any problem. One day I was at Mass, and I couldn't read the missalette properly. And I was driving from Mass to work, and I couldn't, everything was double. The further I tilted my head back, the worse the double vision became. And I just thought it'll go away. A couple of days later, I had to have my one eye closed or my chin to my chest to see properly. It didn't go away, so I went to a ophthalmologist, and he did several tests, sent me to a neuro-ophthalmologist. That's when they ordered the MRI, and that's when they discovered the large tumor growing on the stem of the brain. It was just the pressure, you know, the tumor was pushing the brain out, and that's what caused the vision to go bad.
That's right. And can you, I know first the diagnosis was a little bit incorrect in your case, Toby, and what they thought you had originally.
Right. About 3 years prior to the vision going awry, I would on several occasions get real short of breath, almost feel sick, and it would pass. And then on a few different occasions, one day I was in my office, which I'd been at every day for the last 10 years, and I knew I was there, but I didn't recognize a single thing. I called my wife. I said, there's something wrong. I know I'm at work. I know I'm at my desk, but Christina, I've never seen anything that I'm looking at here before. She came down and got me. We went to the doctor, and the doctor said that I was having panic attacks. It was stress-related. Sent me to a psychiatrist. Well, that was, you know, totally understandable. The psychiatrist I went to one time, and we realized we were kind of wasting our time. I was really not under a significant amount of stress. We found out later, after the correct diagnosis, that what that was a neuro seizure, and I'd had several of them. Had they ordered an MRI at that time, they would have found the tumor probably a lot smaller.
Mm-hmm. And I want to go to Samantha now, who I would like her to share her story, because I know you had some kind of a misdiagnosis too, Samantha, with your tumor originally.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I have similar experience to Toby as well. My cyst may have been growing for many, many years, including when I was in grade school, and I had actually had a lot of increasing difficulty reading and doing mathematics, and I had always been a straight-A student and was suddenly losing cognitive abilities. I, too, thought that maybe I was going through periods of stress and so on and so forth. When I was 18, however, I got a terrible, terrible facial pain. I thought it was a toothache. It was an intense trigeminal neuralgia, like a sort of an earthquake in my face that would last for just a few seconds, but would subside. I didn't really know what to make of that. I went to the dentist, and they said, oh, well, your wisdom teeth, we should take those out and so on, and went through the experience of having my wisdom teeth extracted, and I was assuming that that was going to, resolve the pain. It was completely unrelated. In fact, in taking out the wisdom teeth, when they tried to do it in the office under anesthesia, the pain was even more incredibly, it was unbearable, and then they opted to do the wisdom teeth removal under general anesthesia. Now, there should have been some clue that there was something neurological mm-hmm. going on when the anesthesia didn't work. However, I went another year and a half without any type of diagnosis, and the pain, I just kept telling myself that, well, my teeth are just getting used to this new room that they have, and that's how I helped to explain away the little facial pains that I was having, which were, instead of being little after about a year and a half, were getting again more earthquake-like, and I was rating them at my office with friends on a Richter scale, actually. And it got to be sort of a joke, but I then finally said, I can't live with this anymore. And I went to a new dentist who said, I don't know what this is, but this is not a toothache. Before I found the dentist who made that observation, I had taken myself to the psychiatrist to say, okay, I've got all this stress. My dentist was indicating that I was grinding my teeth, that maybe I was under stress, and that would explain what this pain was from. And the psychiatrist very aptly said, well, this sounds a little peculiar. Maybe it's something physiological. And so that was very reassuring, but yet who knew what it was. And when I finally was sent to the trigeminal neuralgia specialist by the dentist, the diagnosing dentist, the trigeminal neuralgia specialist informed me that I might have multiple sclerosis. And at that point, I was ecstatic because I'd been living with this pain for years at this point and was just excited that there might be some explanation for it. When they did the CAT scans and it came back and they said, well, we have good news. It's not multiple sclerosis. See, there's this little cystic space on the skin. That's good because that's at the base of your skull, and we can take that out. We think it's an epidermoid cyst. The word brain tumor was never used, perhaps to not scare me, but it was a very, you know, difficult process of getting a diagnosis. And then just sort of as an amusing anecdote, once the tumor was successfully removed during an 18-hour surgery, I still wasn't feeling back to normal after at least 6 months, and I went back to a neurologist. I didn't have a neurologist when I was diagnosed. I had a dentist who diagnosed me rather than a neurologist, and went to a neurologist with my symptoms of dizziness, fatigue, trouble with concentration and attention, feeling like I was in pea soup all the time. And I had the neurologist said, oh, well, now it sounds like you're malingering and you really need to go back to the psychiatrist. So it was sort of ironic that, you know, once the tumor was physically gone, then I was back to being crazy. And that's not the case at all. I've discovered that a relatively new term is being used is acquired brain injury, that the tumor itself and the process of removing it and possibly another incident where I fell in the hospital may have impacted my brain, and so that I have an acquired brain injury as a result of the whole tumor experience. And I believe many people may experience similar problems.
That's right, and I'd like to talk a little bit more about acquired brain injury in a moment. But sure. First, I'd like to remind our listeners that you can join our conversation about brain tumors by calling 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, or toll-free 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL. And tell me, I wanted to ask if you have any deficits or anything from the surgery that you experience now?
Yeah, I have no peripheral vision on my left side. Mm-hmm. I just literally, it's not just the one eye, it's both eyes. The Dr. Meyer, the surgeon, said that my eyes would work perfect in anybody else's head.
Right.
But to get to the tumor, they had to take out part of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
He showed it to me. It's kind of like when you see a yard aerated, how they take a little plug out to get to the tumor. And he said, the piece of your brain that we took out, pretend that's the part of the camera that holds the film.
Right.
Your eyes can see it, but the message isn't being sent to your brain.
And Dr. Brodus, do we have any idea what might be causing brain tumors, why there is such a high incidence of them?
Well, boy, that's a discussion in and of itself, Maeve. I think that as far as cancer in general is concerned, from what we recognize today in the year in 2003, is the following. I think that most people out there in the listening audience who have some experience in back here, and certainly as some of our interests may have allowed us to read deeper in the subject, we now find that all of us, meaning all of us in this room and in the audience out there, have a potential for acquiring one form of a tumor or cancer, if you will, during our lifetime. We're born with these deficiencies that control the way in which cells multiply. And also, there are certain key factors along the pathways that control cell division that allows certain cells to multiply even quicker than what they're supposed to multiply. You can think about comparing these mechanisms, these genes, if you will, like having an accelerator and a brake in a car. You can form a tumor by having your foot on the accelerator all the time and not being able to control that, having the brake disconnected from the car, not being able to stop an abnormal growth. And we do have very excellent ways within our body to control mishaps from either of those two, the accelerator or the brake problem. But sometime during our life, whether it begins when we're children or later on in development as adults, we have multiple injuries to these genes that allow these genes to finally express the ability to go out of whack or go out of control. And these factors may come from exposures to certain toxins that we're aware of, chronic repeated trauma, as you've mentioned earlier, but generally been, poo-pooed by certain specialists and certain authorities, I should say, and really upheld by other authoritatives. But we do know that there is a relationship between repeated trauma and something like meningiomas, which you had mentioned earlier. But in general, for other primary tumors involving the brain direct, it's not a quite clear answer, other than mentioning to the audience and to us that we do have an inherent weakness in allowing these tumors to form during our lifetime. And also, there are very many people out there that have these growths and never even know it. And they pass away from other reasons and causes, and they may have never, ever showed a symptom in any form.
And what kind of symptoms? We heard Toby had blurred vision and Samantha had dental problems that precipitated this. But what other symptoms might there be?
Absolutely. The brain is just fascinating. Obviously, I spent most of my life and career studying it in very different ways as a neurologist, a neurosurgeon, a radiation specialist, and then some as a researcher. But it all falls down to the basics of what the brain does. And very simply, what the brain does is just orchestrate various functions that allow the body to perform movement, sensation, vision, taste, and just reasoning, being able to think. That is what the brain does. And when you look at the brain, whether it's by imaging, by an MRI or a CT scan or grossly, at the brain, you have to envision that there are various sections within the brain, kind of like a map of the United States, where California is responsible for this function and New York is responsible for a different function and Florida is responsible for yet another function. And whether you have a metastatic tumor or a primary tumor or an extra axial, meaning something that doesn't even belong to the brain but exerts pressure on the brain, very similar to Samantha's situation, you can have its related symptoms bearing on where in the brain is causing these pressure-like symptoms. So people can present with headaches, with just cognitive dysfunction, memory issues, motor issues of weakness, numbness, and seizures. And I do have to add to that one of the very important and basic differences between cases like Samantha and cases like Toby is that when you're dealing with primary brain tumors, the actual cells within the brain are being infected, if you will, by this uncontrollable growth. And as the growth takes over the cells, it destroys it and leaves a path of destruction along its wake. And the tumors like Toby's situation, which runs the spectrum from being a lower grade or a less active tumor to a higher grade or an incredibly very active tumor, is that these tumors, in different rates of growth, if you will, they have the uncanny ability to do three things. They take over the cell's mechanism of growth, they invade new territories, they form new blood vessels for themselves, and they are able to establish new patterns of pathways and delivery systems that can affect any portion of the brain from the very start. And that's why primary brain tumors, specifically the gliomas, which incorporates the type of tumor that Toby has, are so incredibly difficult to control and treat. So in Toby's situation, his vision is a problem that is related to the type of tumor that he had, as those cells were destroyed by the initial tumor itself. So as you remove that tumor, you're actually removing those dead cells, and your approach to that tumor is going to be such that that you're going to be trying to avoid having to go through further brain that is functional. And we have just remarkable equipment nowadays to allow us to safely approach any tumor within the brain as safe as we possibly can. And these tools are unfortunately not available at most hospitals, but certainly to our listening area here in Central Illinois, we work with these types of tools day in and day out. And we're so very grateful certainly for our area, to have these types of technologies available to our patients.
Well, that pretty much brings me to my next question, which is what to do once you are diagnosed with a tumor. And Toby, I just wondered if you could relate really briefly how your diagnosis and how I know you got a second opinion, and if you could relate that.
Sure. But real quick, Doctor, were you referring to the stealth system by chance?
Yes.
When you were talking, that's what they used on me, which is just an incredible. Oh. It's incredibly painful, but incredibly effective.
Boy, Toby and I are kind of looking at it and kind of smiling. Is that the technology available nowadays is very. It's one system of what we call a neuronavigational system. Of course, being the country that we are, we have many types of models of cars and different styles for different people. So we have different manufacturers for these neuronavigational devices, and Stealth is certainly one of them. And I'm sorry, I'm not promoting a certain company or a product here, but...
Can you explain what the Stealth system is?
Very simply, you can relate it to the following. Most cars nowadays do have what's called navigational devices, that the car itself, or you can buy an aftermarket that has a little transmitter that transmits the location of your particular car to a satellite up in space. And through this constant communication, you can see on your TV monitor or screen in the car exactly where you are positioned wherever you are traveling in relationship to the satellite up in space. So essentially with the stealth-like system that was used on Toby and I use on a similar type of device on my patients, is that you place fiducial markers, which, as I think I had mentioned earlier in a separate discussion, these fiducial markers are kind of like mileposts on a highway that if you get stuck in the middle of nowhere and you happen to call 911 or the highway patrol and he says, well, I'm not sure where I'm at, but I'm right next to mile marker 120 and highway number 39, then highway patrol or 911 knows exactly where you're at. So these little devices taped on fiducials that we tape onto the scalp, for example, can communicate directly with the computer in the CT or the MRI scanner, and this information is fed directly into the computer in the operating room that's hooked up to the microscope. And as you're starting to begin your case in removing a brain tumor, you can look at the monitor and tell where you're going to make your incision, whether it's directly over the tumor, directly and over an area of the brain that's very functional that you don't want to go. And as you're dissecting through and projecting into the tumor, it can lead you away from very important structures like major arteries and vessels and other territories that you don't want to be in. So it's made a surgery of deep-seated tumors much more safer and much more formidable and complete than we ever had before.
And I wanted to go back to Toby if you would, about talking about your experience with the diagnosis and treatment.
Well, the original diagnosis was it's an astrocytoma, grade 4, very fast-growing, extremely aggressive. That was after the biopsy. And there were a few terrific friends, doctors in town, that said, no, we can't accept that. We've got to get a second opinion. So they sent some of the tissue that they removed from the tumor to the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. Dr. Scheitower looked at it and said, we're not quite sure, but you better get him up here. And, of course, Dr. Meyer took a look at it, and he said, you know, here's your options. You know, something's got to be done. It's just the size of a large fish growing on the stem of your brain. It's amazing that you haven't, you know, that you're still here. He said, I would recommend surgery. It's your only chance of survival. You've got a 40% chance of death, a 60% chance of not knowing who you are, and the real bad news is you're going to have to be awake. And that's where the stealth system comes into play. The surgery is about 7.5 hours, and the entire time they were asking questions. Uh-huh. After they got, you know, I did have some anesthesia. They didn't give me a shot of Novocaine in the scalp, so I didn't feel that at all. But everything after that I felt pretty well. The bone saw. Ooh. And et cetera, which
wasn't too pleasant.
But,
I mean,
the thing is, it was kind of nice because I never had to lay there thinking they're going to put me to sleep now and I may never wake up.
That's true. So we do have a call on line one from Champaign, so I'd like to take that, please. Go ahead, line one.
Hi. I'm listening to Toby's story, and I'm just amazed. I actually have had a meningioma in the cavernous sinus region. And we decided to do the Gamma Knife treatment, and my meningioma was about the size of an egg, I'd say. So we had this treatment done in Pittsburgh, actually, and I'm fine. I took 2 weeks off of work, and I'm back at work, and I still have headaches occasionally, well, fairly regularly, actually, but I'm actually doing very well. So I just am curious to know. We had the option of doing surgery but decided not to, and I'd just be curious to see what Dr. Meyer would.
Dr. Rodas here.
And, Carla, how long ago was your treatment?
It was in July.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Dr. Rodas.
Sure. I'm sorry, ma'am, I didn't catch your name.
What is your name?
I'm sorry, ma'am, I didn't catch your name.
My name is Sally Prunty.
Oh, Sally. Hi, Dr. Rodas here. And
okay.
Think you were...
Yeah, we spoke.
Yes.
I didn't realize that was you.
It's a small world.
Yeah, that's neat.
Well, I congratulate you for having that option. I think that certainly, you know, all patients and family should have options available to them when they're dealing with you know, what I figure the most important part of our whole body system. I may have some angry callers coming in from cardiology, by the way, or you know, but be it as it may, with meningiomas of the cavernous sinus, very much like Samantha's ordeal, depending on where these particular tumors are, they can be dreadful, and the medicine can be worse than the disease, you know, in these situations based on location. And before I further discuss your situation and your very good option that was given to you, I should say the following. You know, as a neural-based person who specializes on brain tumors, I try to avoid the use of the word cancer, tumor, benign, malignant when I talk to my patients and my family, because that creates obviously a certain identification of uncomfortableness, both for them and myself. And I don't sugarcoat things. I'm very much open-minded as well. I do not give false hopes, nor do I blatantly say something that is not factual or true. But I think that any patient or family who is dealing with these issues, whether it's a cystic lesion such as Samantha's, a cavernous meningioma such as yourself, or an oligo tumor such as Toby's, you know, they are frightened. They are surely frightened, and it's that fright that carries a tremendous amount of despair. So I never use those terms. What I prefer to use is the following, and I'll tell you why. I prefer to use the terms either you have a growth that's located in such and such place, that this particular growth has these properties that we think it is growing slow or it's growing fast. And then I will expand on that sort of thought depending on how well families and patients are listening, because as you know, when we're confronted with very frightful information from the very start, we don't hear half the things that we are being told. We're concentrating on the fear, this is cancer. But with your particular type of growth, Sally, it is a tumor, of course, that is not within the brain itself. It's within the covering of the brain. And because the brain has all types of deep crevices and valleys and peaks and all that, the covering of the brain, or what's called the dura, envelopes the top, the front, the back, the bottom portion, the brainstem, even certain very tight areas of nerve covering, such as Samantha's. And when you look at certain territories, the cavernous sinus used to be what's considered no man's land. No one would ever dare to go into this area because of the company that keeps is usually kept within this this closet, if you will. It's a tremendous amount of blood supply that is kept in this closet. major arteries, major draining veins, major nerves that control your vision, your control your eye movement, control your the sensation throughout your face. So in removing tumors of the cavernous sinus, you as a surgeon would have to confront complications in and of itself of trying to get to the tumor, let alone removing the tumor and taking all these cranial nerves. So that's what I meant by the medicine. Sometimes it's worse than the actual disease, you know. I think that there are surgeons that are skull-based surgeons, which are neurosurgeons. One of my partners here in our practice is an excellent skull-based surgeon trained by one of the world's best skull-based surgeons. And he incidentally trained in Pittsburgh. Now, what we've learned from the masters of skull-based surgeries over their experience of 20, 30 years is that we have, as a general group of neurosurgeons, created, unfortunately, a devastation of in patients in trying to remove every single little cell of tumor in that area, whether it be meningiomas or other tumors that can affect the skull base. And we put out pictures in our conferences that say, hey, look at what I've done. I've taken out this tumor entirely. But nobody really talked about the complications that happen when you remove these tumors. Yeah. So what has happened with the with just the progression of imaging that we have seen with MRIs and then some, and with the new technology with radiosurgery such as yourself with Gamma Knife, and there's also yet another technology that we were talking about before we started the radio program called CyberKnife, which is a completely robotic system where people don't have to have that frame on that you had. That it's controlled entirely by a robot, and the radiation is delivered exactly just the same as a Gamma Knife and exactly the same period of time and produces exactly the same type of effects but without the frame. And the nice thing about something like the CyberKnife is that you are not obligated to give the entire treatment that you need to give in one single dose, which probably that's the way they treated you in Pittsburgh, isn't it, Sally?
Yeah.
One shot, yeah. See, and the problem of doing that is that you don't want to put back these frames in patients' heads because they're not the most comfortable thing to have. I mean, for the most part, people tolerate them very well, but when you ask them after, you know, a 6-8 hour ordeal, what was the worst part of your day? I say, oh, man, that damn frame, you know. They'll always routinely tell you. But, you know, we are making a lot of progress in the form of radiosurgery, but the basis of what my discussion with you, Sally, is that we have now changed our views in that if we can safely remove a portion of these types of tumors from the cavernous sinus that is causing compression of vital nerves, then we can come back in and use radiosurgery to mop up the rest of the tumor safely. Because as you well know, and the question I believe that Samantha was getting at in asking you how long did you have it, is that unfortunately with radiosurgery or any form of radiation, its effects don't take hold immediately. I mean, what radiosurgery does is that it exposes these tumor cells, these population of tumor cells, to an incredibly high dose of radiation to the point that these cells can no longer duplicate. But the brain being what it is, it cannot remove these dead cells like the rest of the body can. We don't have a lymphatic system to get rid of these cells. So the mass of cells remain in its place for a number of months before you're able to see a shrinkage of these tumors. So we have to be very cognizant about that sort of thing. But what something like CyberKnife does is that if a radiosurgeon is considering of giving you a certain amount of radiation, and let me throw out a number at you. Let me throw out 25 gray. You're obligated to give 25 gray with the possibility of injuring some neighboring nerves and structures, but you're obligated to only give one dose, you know, based on the inherent properties of the Gamma Knife or other similar form. With radiosurgery from CyberKnife, you can give the same amount of a prescribed dose, 25 gray, but you divide it up into 5 sessions, 5 gray each day for 5 days. And what you've done with that is that you haven't changed the effects of the radiosurgery, but you sure as heck have changed the complication rate of the neighboring, you know, tissues that these tissues are going to be exposed to. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense, actually.
Yeah.
It makes perfect sense.
And,
I will mathematically, if you do 5 doses at 5 gray, I'm trying to figure this out here. What's the difference between that in terms of complication effects from one dose at 25 gray?
Absolutely. Boy, Sally, that's an excellent question. If you're available, we'd like to hire you as our biophysics expert for our cyber project in Bloomington. I'm actually working on a project with the people at Stanford University. There's a Dr. John Adler there who was the inventor of the CyberKnife. And for many, many years, users of whatever equipment of radiosurgery, whether it's LINAC-based, gamma knife-based, etc., we have been, not very accurate in determining what dose we use other than experience from the way that we had used gamma knife, for example, in the old days, 30 years ago, to create lesions anywhere and around the brain. From a biophysical standpoint and the radiobiology standpoint, I do not have a one-to-one answer, a very clean answer for you. But I can tell you that tissues in general, or any cell in general, whether it's the lung, the brain, the colon, were not made to tolerate exposure to radiation, for that matter. And you have to, you are limited in giving so much radiation, not by the cells that you're trying to destroy, not the bad cells, but you're actually limited by the normal cells surrounding the tumor cells. Do you follow me?
Right, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. So from a radiobiological standpoint, we have made some inferences about what it takes to kill these tumor cells or stunt their growth over a period of time without hurting adjacent tissue. So that's where these numbers and these treatment plans come from. But the project I'm working on right now involves a more scientific way of doing that, a better way of prescribing the dosages based on the tumor size, the location, the volume, and the patient as well.
And Samantha, I didn't know if you wanted to jump in with
I do, actually. Okay. I want to underscore and support everything that has been a nice sequence. The bottom line is to get second opinions and to do your homework. At the Healing Exchange Brain Trust, in the support groups that we run online and some face-to-face, we also, really encourage people to get second opinions and to do their homework, because healthcare is becoming more and more a situation where we need to be informed consumers of the different types of treatments that are available. And it's wonderful to be able to have Dr. Rodas here to broadcast what some of the latest techniques are. But as Toby described, his tumor was diagnosed with one tumor type, and then it was found to actually be something else. That's a very common occurrence. Many, many times people are diagnosed with one tumor type, but it turns out to be something else. And oftentimes people who are a little bit more remote, who may be going to a local hospital, they don't find out about some of the things that are available at larger medical centers, hospitals, until they go online to the internet, for example, and find out what is available at other locations. And as Dr. Rodas pointed out, and as we know sort of intuitively, inherently, that the brain is one of the most important organs in our body. It controls all of our other systems, and it is the center of who we are. Our ability to think and to feel, and some people also believe, the center of where our spirit is as well. There's this whole, it's a very complicated system, and we have to really search for the best treatment options. And talking with others about their experiences can sometimes lead to new information and a new way of approaching things. Back about 1995, I think it was, someone who was diagnosed with a glioblastoma tumor might be told that, well, you have 6 months to live. And that's a very dramatic statement to have made to you. And I was so thankful for Dr. Rodas' comments about his avoiding the terms cancer and tumor and benign or malignant, because, you know, it doesn't matter what it is that's in your head. If it's causing mass effect, it could be, again, like mine was a cyst, it can be a tumor. How quickly is it growing? These are things that you need to be aware of. But causing trauma to yourself and to your family by using inflammatory words can be more harm than good. If we talk about, you know, you want to assemble a good healthcare team, one that you're comfortable and that you're confident in, and to actually, you know, do your homework and look at what the different treatment options are. I also want to, you know, just have people keep track of, you know, what some of their symptoms are even after their treatment and so on, because with radiation effects, as the doctor mentioned, sometimes those don't begin to appear until months or even years after the treatment has been done. And this is when, you know, people are now living longer with brain tumors, which is wonderful due to the new technologies and treatments, but there's also new different kinds of complications that, you know, people weren't aware of or prepared for. So it's important to be pay a close attention to your body and the signals that it's giving you about how it's doing.
And I'm sorry, I just want to jump in here because we do have another caller in line two that I'd like to get to from Champaign. Go ahead, line two.
Yes, I had a family member who was diagnosed back in 1979 with an astrocytoma. And she underwent surgery and radiation following that. And she did become disabled. And I guess it sounds like there are lots of many, many different ways to treat that now so that she may not have had the resulting disability. And I guess my main question is, what are the inherited possibilities of brain tumors and certain types of brain tumors in families?
I guess that question is for me. Ma'am, what is your name again?
My name is Joe.
Okay, Joe. Thanks for calling in. Joe, it's a very good question. And, 90% of the time when I meet with families, that's a question always comes up. And fortunately, the relationship isn't that direct. Fortunately, there's about less than 10% of the time as well that we have what's called syndromic problems, in that patients do inherit brain tumors from a prior generation. And we know ahead of time whether these patients are like that because, you know, you see their family members and they can provide you with that type of history historically from affected other people within the family members. But it doesn't apply that way. But you do have to be very cognizant about that as the treating doctor, you know, that this is on their minds. Maeve had asked the question about epidemiology and, you know, certain factors that can allow these break mechanisms, if you will, within our genes to let loose and make it easier for someone who has the gene to express the brain tumor. You know, and we have to be very suspicious that when you see a pattern within a certain region of higher than expected types of cancers, that there may be a factorial issue around that area, whether it's the drinking water, the agriculture, the refinery, exposure to, you know, tobacco, secondhand tobacco, if you believe in that, and et cetera. You can do your own investigation and see, you know, that information is available, by the way, through your Department of Health at any time. And various other organizations can help you in getting that type of data. But fortunately, Joe, there's not that tight of a relationship from one family member to the other.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And Samantha, I just wanted to go back to you real quick. If you could, we're going to have to end really quickly here. So I wondered if you could just give some information about the Healing Exchange Brain Trust, where people might find that on the internet.
Certainly, yes. We have a dozen different online support groups for specific tumor types or just for brain tumors in general. We'd be happy to send anybody information via email. They can email us at info@ braintrust, all one word, .org. So that's info@braintrust.org. And our website is www.braintrust.org. www.braintrust.org. We also have available free gray ribbons. We have a limited number, but we're happy to send gray ribbons to people to increase brain tumor awareness as well. So we'd be happy to send those out to folks.
Well, thanks. This has been a great discussion. I'm sorry I have to cut it short, but I'd like to thank Toby Herges, Dr. Raul Rodas, and Samantha Scolamero for joining me today. I'm Maeve Riley. Joining us now is Jay Pierce. He is today's settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade.